Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We are presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, in the building, to talk some NBA trades, to talk Chet Holmgren, his number one boy. It is Matthew Penny. What up, Ben?
How are we? We're good. It's been a crazy morning, crazy afternoon for you. I'm working on my levels here. I know you saw the interactions on Twitter that my voice doesn't align to my body. And it was compared to Jim Halpert from The Office, Toby from This Is Us, and Braun Strowman from pro wrestling fame. A couple new ones in there for me. I've gotten the Jim from The Office, the John Krasinski once in a while. He's like the Coca-Cola, and I'm like the RC Cola version of that. And he actually grew up down the street from where I'm recording. But the other ones were new ones. So I'm just trying to be a little bit less self-conscious here and power through and talk trades, which is a little out of my comfort zone. But we're prepared. We do the best we can.
We're ready. Matt Penny is nothing if he's not always prepared.
I'm prepped.
And I told him last night, like, hey, you know, just let's talk trades in the morning. Yeah. Just do a little bit of prep and, you know, be ready. And he's always ready. And now was he ready for the Kings to, like, totally, like, break my brain? No, he wasn't.
To be fair, was anyone? Was the NBA? I mean, the reports coming out like, hold on, wait a minute. Like, we didn't even know this was a possibility. And now he's a Pacer.
Yeah, Woj is literally just like, these are calling me being like, "What? If we would have known Tyrese Haliburton was available, like, what's going on?" Okay, let's settle this and let's start ripping videos for the YouTube page, essentially. We're going to go one in order, right? We're going to go Tyrese Haliburton for Domantas Sabonis. We're going to go CJ McCollum to the Pelicans. We're going to go Caris LeVert to the Cavs, and then we're going to talk Chet Holmgren. We had another draft topic that we might not get to.
No.
I actually don't think we're going to do mailbag today because there's just too much going on, but we will do prospects of the week. So I know you guys love mailbag. Maybe we'll do an extra long mailbag episode next week in order to make up for it. We apologize, but I mean, this just got out of our hands a little bit here with the way that this occurred during the deadline. So, okay, let's start. Yeah. The Indiana Pacers have traded Domantas Sabonis, Jeremy Lamb, Justin Holiday, and a 2027 second-round pick to the Indiana Pacers for Tyrese Haliburton, Buddy Hield, and Tristan Thompson. This is the one that just totally broke my brain. Like, yeah. I looked at Twitter this morning. It's 8:22 a.m. here in Australia, and I thought someone like had fucked up. Like, I thought someone
they might have.
Yeah, like I thought it was like
a fake account, fake Twitter account. You're like, I fell for it again. That's a fake one.
Yeah, it's all a ruse. It's all like fake Woj coming at us. This is staggering to me. I'll give you the floor before I, like, you know, jump up and down on all of this. But go ahead.
You're taken aback. I love Tyrese Haliburton. I was surprised. I thought the Kings would move a different guard, maybe De'Aaron Fox, and build around Tyrese Haliburton, who's shooting like 48% from the field, 45% from three. It felt that the Kings nailed this draft pick, and after they haven't in the past, and I just, yeah, for just checking it out, I looked up the last, whatever, five, six drafts of who they have and who they missed, and 2013, Ben McLemore, 7th. 2014, Nick Stauskas, 8th. 2015, Willie Cauley-Stein, 6th. 2016, Marquese Chriss, 8th. They feel like they got it fairly right with De'Aaron Fox, 5th in 2017.
Oh, you missed another one there with Marquese Chriss.
No, Marquese Chriss, 2016. He went 8th. We said swipe.
No, but there's another one in there.
Oh.
That's our king. Yorios Papayannis, baby.
Yeah, sure.
Number 13. That's a lottery pick.
That's true. I'm trying to hit on the hits. Bagley was a miss. And Haliburton at 12 seemed like an actual hit, right? Like, we got it right. Even this year, Davion Mitchell, we're both Davion Mitchell fans, but we're like, that's a crowded backcourt. I didn't see this. I don't know how this works. Haliburton is a guy that we've raved about, that archetype lately, of this big, passing, connecting, seamless guy that can play anywhere. He's actually shooting the ball. Any of the questions coming out of college are erased, and he is traded. I like Sabonis. I do. I think I just value Tyrese Haliburton so much higher. when that tweet came out that he was gone, it was kind of like I was back on the end of the bench losing a buzzer beater. I just put my hands in my head and I just said, I don't know what's happening here. This can't be a real thing.
Yeah. So I don't want to give short shrift to Domantas Sabonis, who's
correct. Correct. Yes.
And before we dive into undoubtedly why I wouldn't have done this move if I was the Kings, I want to pay attention to why Domantas Sabonis is probably someone that the Kings valued and decided they wanted to acquire. Sabonis is one of the best offensive centers in the NBA. He averages essentially 20 points, 12 rebounds, 5 assists, something like that. He's exceptional in dribble handoffs. His feel for the game is outstanding. He's kind of like a bull in the china shop in the paint. Like, he is incredible in terms of being able to use his shoulders, use his footwork to be able to carve out just that little inch of space that he needs to finish at the basket. His dribble handoff game, I think, is really going to mesh well with De'Aaron Fox. If there's any – look, the Kings have an interim coach right now in Alvin Gentry. Alvin Gentry is a really fucking smart offensive mind. I think Alvin Gentry is going to be able to figure out how to utilize De'Aaron Fox and Domantas Sabonis well together. And the way to do it is you start the ball with Davion Mitchell in his hands. You put De'Aaron Fox on the right side of the court. You run essentially like a dribble handoff action. You put the ball in Sabonis' hands. You have Mitchell go screen to the right side of the court, have Fox come up and fly up to get him on the move. And then you run like all sorts of crazy dribble handoff action with Fox where he's on the move already and you can let Sabonis make some decisions and dribble handoffs. Like, I think there's actually a lot there that will work for Sacramento. Yep. And ultimately, a big part of why Sacramento has not been very good this year, they're sitting at 20-35 and they're 13th in the West and don't look all that competitive. But a big part of why that's the case is because De'Aaron Fox has not been very good. I thought he was going to take a leap into all-star territory this year. That hasn't happened. And acquiring Domantas Sabonis is hopefully something that will actualize what De'Aaron Fox can be.
However,
I can't wrap my brain around trading essentially 7 or 8 years of Tyrese Halliburton, which is what you would have had at this point, who has been your best player this year. You look, since December 1st, Tyrese Halliburton's been averaging 16 to 17 points, 9 assists. He has been at 1.6 steals per game, 4 rebounds. He has a near 4-to-1 assist to turnover ratio. He's shooting 43% from 3, and he's doing it on a lot of pull-up attempts that, you know, we can talk about what the evaluation of Tyrese Halliburton was coming into the NBA. That was the question. Like, could he consistently knock down the pull-up jumper? And whether or not that was the case was going to be whether or not he could turn into, you know, something of an all-star point guard.
Right.
That skill is here. It is translated. It is everything that you could want from him. He is a 21-year-old that is essentially a 16-9-4 point guard who is efficient, who is a really smart team defender, who is continually getting stronger, because like that was another question. Like, could he get strong enough? He was about 175 pounds entering the NBA. He's now up to like 185 or so, and he looks bigger, looks bulkier on the court, can hold his own a lot better. That's going to just continue to improve. I see no reason to think that Tyrese Halliburton isn't going to be an all-star. Based off of everything that we've seen from the Kings this year, every sign has been, I am breaking out. I am a breakout player. This is happening
for Tyrese Halliburton. Around me. I fit in any offense you want.
Build around me. I am a scalable player. I can shoot. I can pass. I play great team defense. Like, even if you're going to get a star player to put next to Tyrese Halliburton, he fits next to all of them. Mm-hmm. He fits next to whatever you want to build. That is part of his value. It's part of why the Kings probably loved him. And they moved him. And I understand it. because they have been so attached to De'Aaron Fox since selecting him. And I would bet you that the way that they looked at this was the best way for us to actualize the next few years is by cashing in on Tyrese Haliburton and not cashing in on De'Aaron Fox at the nadir of essentially what his value would be, because that's what he would be at right now. Like, he would be at a low point in terms of value, given the long-term nature of his contract, given his play this year. I bet that they're thinking we can rehabilitate De'Aaron Fox's, you know, NBA play this year. He's going to be great next to Domantas Sabonis, and we're going to make it work. I think that is the wrong choice. I would have built around Tyrese Haliburton, who is one of the best, most exciting young guards in the NBA right now. If you ask any Kings fan at this point, I think that they would tell you they were more excited about Tyrese Haliburton than De'Aaron Fox. It just kind of blew me away. Yeah. It's one of those things that, like, in the macro, I can't really even fathom. In some respect, making the decision to pick Haliburton over Fox, essentially.
And, well, maybe you had to, like you said, just based on trade value or whatnot. And I'm always drafty. I'm always bringing back the draft. We do it all over again. He probably goes fourth, right, somewhere, like LaMelo and Edwards, Desmond Bain, him, somewhere around there.
Yeah, and I think you go ahead of Bain. To be, sure. I love so, Desmond.
Like, okay, so he's but, third or fourth, right? My point being that LaMelo's an all-star. Anthony Edwards is close. I think Desmond Bane is going to be awesome there as a number two. Could they have gotten more for Tyrese Haliburton? We're laughing. We're joking, saying teams didn't even know. If it was known that he was on the trading block, could they have got more in return than Domantas Sabonis? And people might be going nuts saying, he's an all-star. He's already 2012. What are you talking about? But could have been packaged together with more picks, more assets, two of those type of guys, if people around the league feel as strongly and passionately about his game where it is now and where it's going to go as you and I do talking on here. Did they sell himself short? It's like, if this is the guy, right, and we're saying that, could they have actually gotten more in return too?
So I think the answer is yes. And part of that is that I am not a big fan of Domantas Sabonis as a number one or number two option. I would have loved it if the Warriors would have been like, hey, we think Domantas Sabonis would be an unbelievable fit in our motion offense next to Draymond Green, next to Klay Thompson, next to Stephen Curry. That's what we're cashing in our chips for. Like, moving James Wiseman and Moses Moody, keeping Jonathan Kuminga. We're going to get Sabonis. That's how we're going to beat teams. We're going to be big. We're going to have a great center. If anyone would have watched the Warriors, I can't remember if it was last night or two nights ago. Everything is very fuzzy at this point from the last like 36 hours, obliterated on the glass.
Yeah. Was that the Kuminga Moody game, or is that the game before? One of those games. They get beat in the glass.
Me remember things.
and Wiseman's coming back. I also don't want to say like he's going to get up to full strength and throw him in the mix immediately. Right. Say, hey, you're paying 25 minutes a game and we're chasing a championship right now. I'd rather take a more seasoned veteran who's used to it, where it's not going to be this enormous adjustment that doesn't have to be worked along slowly too to get there.
Yeah. So like, if it was me and I was the Warriors, like, that's an interesting move for me. I love the idea of Domantas Sabonis there. I don't love the idea of Domantas Sabonis in a situation in Sacramento where he doesn't now really have the defensive insulation that he needs in order to be successful on that end.
Right.
Teams are going to obliterate De'Aaron Fox, Domantas Sabonis pick and rolls. They're just going to absolutely obliterate them. Neither of those two are good enough in space. And now, instead of having Miles Turner coming over from the weak side, who's one of the 10 best defenders in the NBA, you don't really have anyone. Cause like, I'll be honest, like Rashawn Holmes isn't that defender, but also like you kind of can't keep Rashawn Holmes on this roster, I don't think, because part of what makes Rashawn Holmes so good is that he's an unbelievable pick and roll big who's incredibly efficient, finishes at 68%. And on top of that, he loves the short roll and, you know, take that little like push shot floater thing.
Well, on top of that too, he was great in the two-man game with Tyrese Halliburton. That was like his partner in crime for that stretch where Halliburton was averaging double digit assists for like five or six games in a row.
Right. So just the idea of what makes Rashawn Holmes so good, it doesn't really work next to Sabonis, who loves that mid post area where Rashawn Holmes tends to roll into and who, you know, tends to like end up in the range of like that, you know, short roll area and dribble handoffs, right? Yep. Like it's just not really going to work. Sorry, I got a text message like right in the middle of that.
There you are. The Halliburton trade is not real.
Yeah. Literally about the Halliburton trade from like an NBA person. I'm trying to figure out like what they're doing.
It's 8 in the morning. Leave me alone. I'm recording. I'm writing an article. I'm doing my best. I'm processing. This is taking me a little bit longer than I'd like it to.
So in terms of long-term planning, you've given up 7 to 8 years of Tyrese Halliburton to pick up a player that I think minimizes your ceiling in Domantas Sabonis, because I don't think he's good enough defensively. He's a great offensive player, but I don't think he's good enough on defense without incredible insulation to where it's really, truly going to work on that end. And Justin Holiday is a good defender. He's not a great defender. Harrison Barnes is a good defender. He's not a great defender at this point. Like, Davion Mitchell's a great defender, but if I'm an opposing team, I'm just keeping Davion Mitchell out of every screening action that I can.
Going under.
And you mentioned the idea of Davion Mitchell. And getting back to the point that I want to make here, I guess maybe to close before, I'll give you another point before we move on. But like, taking Davion Mitchell in last year's draft seemed bonkers at the time for the Kings, given that they already had De'Aaron Fox and Tyrese Halliburton.
And Buddy Hield.
Mm-hmm. Because you – look, I'm not saying that – I think that they probably have a lot of pressure to make the playoffs in Sacramento. Vivek is a hands-on owner, and, you know, a rookie probably wouldn't have, like, made the difference between them going from 20 and 35 to – you know, whatever they would need, 25 and, you know, 30 or whatever. But I do think that having Davion Mitchell on this roster gives you a comfort level to trade Tyrese Halliburton that maybe you shouldn't. And like, for whatever reason, I don't know why this is, but in my brain, I have that image of, have you ever seen Walk Hard with Dewey Cox?
Yep. Yeah.
I keep having the image of the dad saying, "Wrong kid, dad." And it's just like, wrong point guard traded.
Well, it's like, see, you have multiple cars in the garage. Like, I'm going to drive this one today. It's like, don't drive that one. Sell the other one. The closing point I have with the Kings, and then we at least have to praise Indiana for doing this, I think, right? Yeah. So the Kings are 20 and 35. They're 13th in the West. If they don't make the playoffs and this thing goes south and they have a top three pick, the top three picks are dominated by more bigs. So it's going to be even more crowded. If you have Sabonis, you don't move Rashawn Holmes, and then what? You're not going to pick Chet Holmgren or Jabari Smith? You're going to try to trade down, take one of those guys and trade somebody else?
Well, here is what I will say. Chet Holmgren is kind of an incredible fit with Domantas. Like, he's the one that like could make this work. If they completely flail the rest of the way, like,
all right.
he's the one where it's some
silver lining. And they got to draft him, right? If they have that pick, like don't go bonkers when you have that pick and take the safer play, but safer for their fit.
Yeah, no, I'm blown away. Like I
think you did pretty well for how blown away you were. You actually contextualized a little bit.
Yeah. So in the case of Indiana, you're right. We should talk about Indiana. I am such a fan. I mean, like the Pacers, you know, two of my favorite prospects in the last two drafts were Tyrese Halliburton and Chris Duarte. So now they're together, and that makes me happy.
It's great. Like, it's Sam's fantasy team, but they're also 13th, which is interesting because then in the West, Sacramento is 13th. And I thought the same with Duarte too. And this started with the Caris LeVert trade a little bit, is that is this some sort of statement of belief in Chris Duarte slash is this where the value of actually drafting older makes sense? Like he's 24, mm-hmm. but maybe him producing and being 24 helped you move LeVert. And ironically, you acquired picks to get younger. So right now they have somewhere between like the fifth and eighth pick. They got like 22 and 32. So now you can take those guys, the end of the first round, early second, and pre-draft and stash away guys. And if everybody gets healthy, your core can be Malcolm Brogdon, Tyrese Halliburton, Chris Duarte, Miles Turner, all the draft picks. Like, that's not a bad build for the future, from my view anyway, for the Pacers.
Yeah, and they have Malcolm Brogdon still. Like,
yeah, as long as he gets healthy, right?
Really good player that, you know, if he stays healthy, will be really valuable. If I was them, I would probably move Brogdon this summer. They can't move him at the deadline because of the fact that they gave him an extension. But if I was them, I'd probably move him this summer for like an athletic guard. Like, I would want someone that can like really truly break down a defense next to Tyrese Halliburton and Chris Duarte, because Halliburton's really improved there. And I think that, you know, that ultimately is now the skill. Now that he has the pull-up jumper down, like, him being able to really truly break down defenders is going to be the thing that tells the tale of his ceiling. Like, how much pressure can he consistently put on the rim? Hasn't been a lot yet, but, you know, I think the Pacers need someone that can regularly do that. And Chris Duarte is not really that guy either. So if I was the Pacers, that's what I would look to do: acquire a really good guard who can pressure the basket at a high level and look to improve that way. You know, I'm not saying it'll be this guy, but like someone in the vein of a Jalen Suggs, like someone who fits their timeline, that is just like a super downhill creator who defends at a high level, on the ball particularly, and is just really aggressive, is what I would look for.
Well,
like, it won't be Jalen Suggs because Orlando's going to keep him, but someone maybe, like that.
But maybe that's also without the trade. Say the Brogdon thing doesn't work, you get somebody else. Kind of what we have in the draft, and Jaden Ivey, you have like that fourth, fifth-ish type pick. Like, that's a possibility too. Not a long commute for him to go to Purdue down to Indiana to play for the Pacers. I'm not trying to get too far down the line, but those are probably some of the possibilities they thought about. And getting younger and looking at the freshman class, and let's just stash and let these guys develop over time. We're not going to win this year, but build around Tyrese Halliburton, build around maybe Chris Duarte and the other pieces they already have.
Yeah, if I was them, I would pretty aggressively pursue Jaden Ivey in this year's draft. I think that's the exact guy that they need to make this work. But we'll see. I think that the Pacers are off to a very strong start in their rebuild. They have a lot of really smart guys that are really scalable players, which will allow them to hopefully get the star here moving forward. It's almost like a Raptorsian rebuild where they got the guys that fit around the star, and now the Raptors try and find the star, and it might be Scottie Barnes. You know, it might be this version of Pascal Siakam that's been incredible since he has returned from his like year and a half where he wasn't awesome. But by keeping OG Anunoby, and I mean, Fred VanVleet has turned into something different, but he was a guy that like had a really high floor, like some of the guys we're talking about, like Chris Duarte and Tyrese Halliburton, right? Yeah. But by keeping some of the guys that they kept around, Gary Trent Jr., signing him to his extension, they've set themselves up really well to have the pieces in place that once they get the star, develop the star, they're going to be able to make a leap up the East. And we're seeing that literally right now with what's going on. So, okay, let's go to the next deal. The New Orleans Pelicans acquire CJ McCollum, Larry Nance Jr., and Tony Snell from the Portland Trailblazers for Josh Hart, Tomas Satoransky, Nikhil Alexander-Walker, Didi Luzada, a 2022 protected first round pick that has some kind of funky protections on it.
Yeah.
It's essentially like protected for this year to where the Blazers get it if it's between 5 and 14, I believe.
Yep.
Which, frankly, is probably where the Pelicans end up at this point, barring a weird playoff surge here if they get Zion Williamson back. In 2 second-round picks. Okay. Weird deal for a number of reasons. One that I don't want to spend as much time talking about just because it is hard to analyze it without knowing what's going on with Zion Williamson. If Zion Williamson is healthy, CJ is kind of an awesome fit, I think.
I agree.
As a shot creator, as someone who can be a pick and roll partner for Zion, they would have a second side shot creator there with Brandon Ingram that I think would fit really well. Devontae Graham and CJ McCollum is a disastrous defensive fit in the backcourt that probably will not go well, especially when mixed with Zion, who has been a mess defensively so far. I don't love that aspect of it. Also, Brandon Ingram's not great defensively.
Well, hold on, they have Herb Jones, who, if you talk to fans, they act like he's the second coming. He has an unbelievable rookie season. I think he's a great glue guy for that group.
Yeah.
But a lot kind of relies on, and even Larry Nance, does he get healthy? Does Zion get back and get healthy? We can't really talk about what that starting five looks like because there's just so many variables right now that we don't know. Does Jose Alvarado continue the run that he's on? I'm a believer in Trey Murphy over time. Where does that thing go? There's possibilities there. It's also a funky-ish deal because the Pelicans and Blazers are 10th and 11th. They kind of have like the same exact standing. They're just like, hey, let's move a few chairs around here and see kind of what it pops.
Yeah. It's weird to me that the Pelicans prioritize CJ McCollum given that he doesn't totally fit their age timeline. To me, that probably says that there's some pressure to make the playoffs within the next couple of years, either from the Zion Williamson camp, where they want to be good as soon as possible, or from ownership. But they didn't give up like a crazy amount of value here in order to acquire CJ and Larry Nance Jr., who, by the way, I think is worth like a late first round pick in terms of value. He is one of the more versatile defensive players in the NBA, who's a really good passer. Mm-hmm. I love him in a variety of settings. I actually really like him next to Zion Williamson, to be honest, because Zion can hopefully take on some of the like post-up responsibilities on bigs, and then you can have Larry Nance kind of flying around, hopefully making up for some of Zion's deficiencies there. And they also have Jonas Valanciunas still around, which is still one of the weirder acquisitions of the last year, given his potential fit with Zion. But we'll see how that works whenever Zion actually gets on the court. The Pelicans got better today. They definitely improved their standing right now. Given that you and I have talked a lot about the questions of the 2022 NBA draft, mm-hmm. I think it's probably unlikely that they would get someone at, 10. I think that right now their pick is like 10th or 11th in terms of value. I believe it's 11th because they're in the last spot in the plan. It's unlikely that they would get someone at 11th that would completely change their franchise trajectory. CJ McCollum has a chance to really help. I think they need to go out and find a point guard. Also, if you were going to go out and trade for CJ McCollum, fucking keep Lonzo Ball. Like,
I know that was that made its rounds today on Twitter too. Like, who's the guy? Like a big creating guard doesn't really need to score. Yeah, it's Lonzo Ball. That he was there.
Yeah, and like, look, that's hindsight and everything. But it was a bad move to move him in hindsight, right? Or like at the time. Sorry, it was a silly move to give him up for what they gave him up for at the time. I thought I would have just matched his deal and re-signed him personally, but I understand that, maybe that wasn't the direction they wanted to go, and maybe it wasn't the direction Lonzo wanted to go, right? Mm-hmm. But you're now in a position where your backcourt is Devontae Graham and CJ McCollum, which is not great. Herb Jones can do a lot. So I did rookie rankings today. I have Herb Jones fifth on my rookie rankings.
Wow, high, but earned. Yeah, like he's like, definitely top eight-ish for me. I don't have to put out any rookie rankings, but the guy starts and plays and produces.
The Pelicans, when Herb Jones is on the court, have a plus net rating. When he's off the court, they are 10 points per 100 possessions worse than their opposition. Like, it is, and that's like a noisy number, but it's not an accident that since Herb Jones like entered the starting lineup full time, they are 18 and 17, I believe. So, like, Herb is really valuable, and he's really good defensively, and he makes up for a lot of holes. I don't know if he's making up for that defensive backcourt in terms of a whole, but you can stagger those guys and you can maybe make it work. I worry about playmaking. I worry about this offense stagnating when Devontae Graham isn't out there, because Devontae is an unselfish player who can really shoot and keeps the ball moving a little bit. In the case of CJ McCollum, CJ is best trying to get a shot. And that's not a slight at him. That's just what his like all-star level skill is, right?
And good at it too. And just to add a little color to that, there's a tweet today from Synergy. CJ McCollum has shot an effective field goal percentage of 72% on open spot up jumpers, 50% on pull-ups, and 45% on floaters, while posting assist to turnover ratio of 2.3 in the half court this season. There's value in that. There's value in the scoring. Yeah. You can't just roll the ball and say, hey, we got to score more than they do. Like, yeah, okay. You have to defend too, but it's not a zero. Like there's definitely a price, and the contract's a little crazy too, because he makes so much more money than Josh Hart and everyone else. But if you have to win now and you kind of need a proven scorer, that guy was on the block, you can kind of take what's out there for the taking.
Yeah. I don't hate this, I guess is what I would say. Like that's probably like a wishy-washy answer. I don't mind it. I don't hate it. It's not something that I'm like, I think that it could really help the Pelicans. This is the kind of player that could really help the Pelicans when Zion gets back. But like that's the cloud hanging over this. Like, I don't know what's going to happen with Zion. So what's the, like, it's almost not worth spending more time on it from their perspective, just because we need to see Zion back. Theoretically, CJ McCollum is a great fit with Zion and helps actualize he and Brandon Ingram together. We need to see him back. Like that's kind of what it comes down to.
Right. So let's change gears here. Talk to me about Portland. What are we doing here with Portland? Like, you're move Norman Powell, you move CJ McCollum, and it's not like it's scraps left. It's not, but there's remnants. Like what are we doing here with Damian Lillard? Is this a move? And I know it freed up like $21 million in a trade exemption. You have all this free agency money in the summer. Are they going to be able to lure one of these higher end top tier guys to come out to Portland and play? Or is this a move before a move? And you now have a younger core of Nikhil Alexander Walker, Anfernee Simons, Josh Hart. What does this look like in not even a year, but 4 months from now, 5 months from now?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
We don't have any answers. We're trying.
Theoretically, I like what Portland did here. I thought that to get a lottery pick for CJ McCollum, along with Josh Hart, who's like a good basketball player, like has turned into a pretty valuable player this year, has been really helpful for the Pelicans. Like losing him is actually like a pretty real loss for them. Getting a lottery pick, getting Josh Hart, for CJ is pretty strong, I think. Like I'm a fan of them doing that. It also clears their books to a substantial margin in a way that they really like kind of desperately needed to do. You know, losing you know, the Robert Covington and Norman Powell, I believe that those guys, particularly Powell, had like $75 million left long-term on their deal whenever Portland traded them. And they acquired guys back from the Clippers that had right around like $10 to $12 million left guaranteed on their deal. In this deal, Tomas Satoransky is a expiring contract. Like you don't have to worry about keeping him around. He's gone. Like he'll probably be in Europe next year. Cause he is like completely valueless at this point by NBA standards. Josh Hart's a good player. And if you really need to move Josh Hart this summer, you'd be able to do that. No questions asked. I wouldn't move him. I think he's a pretty useful player and he's, you know, somewhat on their age timeline if they keep Damian Lillard, but if they wanted to move him, they could move him. Nikhil Alexander Walker is like purely a project that like, it's like a second draft reclamation candidate because his just trajectory has not worked out at all in the way that I thought. And oh, by the way, as we're talking, Bradley Beal is undergoing a season ending surgery on his left wrist. So That is going to end any Ben Simmons speculation there.
All right. Real time.
So essentially what Portland is doing, I think, is it's clearing its flexibility in order to do one of two things. They can try and utilize the sign and trade function this summer in order to acquire talent around Damian Lillard that could make sense for them. Or they're setting up to move Damian Lillard this summer. And if I was Philly, I'd be calling about Damian Lillard just right now, just to check in to see what they're doing, because this is not the shape of a...
They're sending the you up text right now. Just to check in.
This is not the shape of a roster, though, that is going to be competitive.
Correct. Moving forward. Yeah, that's where I am, too.
And it wasn't that before, but it's really not that now. And if I was them, I'd be kind of seeing what the market is for Dame right now. I don't think... Look, I'd be surprised if Damian Lillard moved, just because it seems like they're both really committed there to that relationship working. I think Damian Lillard like genuinely wants to win in Portland. If I was an opposing team, I'd be calling about Damian Lillard right now and just seeing what's going on there.
Yeah, take the temperature. The McCollum thing had to happen, though. I mean, they made their Western Conference Finals in 18-19. They finished third in the West. They're eighth the following season, sixth the year after that. Now they're 11th. They've had injuries. They're 21-33. So I get it, but when Dame Lillard does come back healthy, like, he's going to want pieces, and he's done every reboot, remodel possible, that he wants to win. Yeah. And I don't know if it's repackaging of these guys or the trade exemption really works and they really can lure a free agent there. It's just not the easiest thing in the world to do. You can't just clear money and say, hey, we're going to get one of the top six free agent guys out there. They're going to go to other markets first. And then you have to sell the appeal of playing with Dame Lillard than playing with the guys that are currently on your roster. Maybe it takes one domino, and then you get the second guy says, all right, they have Dame, player A, you pull me in there. They have Anthony Simons, who's emerging. You have Josh Hart. Then you're a decent core. But you're probably still two contributors away before they can like make that next leap back into the playoff picture.
So I'm just going to kind of run through Portland's leading scorers so far this year. Damian Lillard, obviously. CJ McCollum, no longer on the team. Norman Powell, no longer on the team. Anthony Simons, restricted free agent this summer, probably going to get a lot of money from Portland, and should. He's been really good. He's averaged 20 points per game since he's entered the starting lineup. You know, useful player, right? Yusuf Nurkic, free agent this summer. Nasir Little, out for the year. Valuable piece moving forward for them, but probably more of like a, you know, lower-end starting wing slash rotational wing. Ben McLemore, just a guy, like minimum scale player. Robert Covington, no longer on the team. Larry Nance Jr., no longer on the team. Those are your top nine in the rotation this year. Yeah, that's... I'd be calling about Damian Lillard at this point, is what I would say.
We're back to Dillard. It's Dame time.
Okay. That's all I have to say about that. Like, Portland needs to figure out direction. If they did this without consulting Dame ahead of time and did this without, like, kind of a real concerted plan in terms of, we are going to move Dame this summer, you know, and then, or we're going to move Dame now in addition to all these guys, or we're going to keep Dame and then bring guys in sign and trades in order to rebuild the roster around him. I think that would be their mistake. We don't yet have enough information to 100% know that. There's a chance this is a big mistake. There's a chance that it's not. And I think I just want more information before we, you know, really dive deep into this.
We're half baked. We're not screaming. We're talking loudly. We could be screaming after the summer, but let's see how free agency kind of shakes out and if there are any more trades. And luckily, I hope Bradley Beal surgery is the last NBA update that we have to adjust to as we're recording here during the trade deadline, which is very fun for all of us.
Okay. Last deal. Caris LeVert to the Cleveland Cavaliers for Ricky Rubio, the Cavs' first round pick this year that is lottery protected, and the Houston Rockets 2022 second round pick, which the Cavs owned. There are also, I believe that Houston, or not Houston, I'm sorry. I believe that Indiana also gets Miami's second round pick this year. So essentially Cleveland or Indiana moves 20 spots up. Or no, Cleveland gets that pick. So Indiana is moving 20 spots up in the second round in addition to acquiring a first round pick.
Yeah.
And the Cavs, I believe, are acquiring a 2027 or 2025 second round pick as well. Something like that. Or there's like a second round pick in there somewhere. What matters here is essentially Caris LeVert for Ricky Rubio, the 22nd pick and like the 33rd pick in the 2022 NBA draft, something like that ballpark. This is a great pickup for the Cavs. I think that Caris is a flawed player, but he's something that Cleveland desperately needed. And they have the insulation around him in order to get the most out of him, actually, because they have the defensive guys that will be able to make up for him when he gets beat on the ball. They have the lack of wing depth and size and shot creation to where Caris will get real opportunities to be able to make things happen with the ball. And on top of that, they give up like a pick here in a draft in 2022 that is not very good, like something like the 20th to 25th pick in the draft. Like, it's good to that's me. Fine. Yeah, Caris helps them. And if you're Indiana, like, it's great to pick up that asset. But like,
that's why it works for both ends. Caris is an injection of offense on a team that has defensive pieces to hide the deficiencies or the holes in his game. And it shows Cleveland's commitment to making a real run at it right now in the Eastern Conference. I was very critical of the moves they made with pairing the bigs together. It's all worked. Darius Garland has been great. They've found ways to play together. And Indiana gets another piece, probably a younger guy, I would guess, at the end of the first round. And that fits what I see anyway as their vision going forward. Just keep building these younger guys around Tyrese Halliburton, Chris Duarte, and Malcolm Brogdon and see where you end up.
Yeah, and they really needed a secondary shot creator on some level next to Darius Garland, because Ricky Rubio, who paired really, really well with Darius early in the season as a second ball handler out on the court, is obviously out for the year with torn ACL. And then Colin Sexton's out for the year with, I believe, torn meniscus. I know it's a knee injury. So they didn't really have that other guy. Like their starting two guard right now is Isaac Okoro, who we both like, but is
defensively, more of a, but I'm not thinking he's an offensive creator.
Right.
I mean, exactly. I have been in a game to make stops, can make an open three here once in a while, but I'm not hitting him on the wing when we're down one in crunch time. Caris LeVert, for the good, the bad, like, he's going to get you some buckets when you need him.
Right. Totally. And Caris needs to play well with others. Like, if you watch the Pacers this year, like, when Caris was on the court, it was like the Caris show. And then when someone else was like running the show, like when someone else was on the court, it was like, oh, this is like a functioning offense. Like, this looks nice. Like, this is really like rolling well. Things look good here. But when Caris was out there, it was just like all Caris all the time. Like, it was so aggressively LeVert centric that it was odd to watch for a team that like does have some good distributors and unselfish players. So he needs to adjust that mindset just a little bit. But if he does that, it's a really good fit next to Darius Garland, who can also play off the ball. Like, that's the big thing for me is like Darius Garland. I mean, you watched him in AAU as much as I did. Like, when he was young, like, he played off the ball. Like, he was not really a point guard until like his junior year of high school, like maybe even like midway through his junior year of high school. Like, it was, he was like an off-guard shooter for a long time, and a lot of those skills have translated to the NBA in the way that he can kind of run off of screens and
do both,
play off the ball and do a lot of different stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, do both in your backcourt, and that's why there's value in the way that he can play interchangeably. And when you make shots and do it at an all-star level, that's easier to put those other scorers or distributors next to you, and you have Evan Mobley, you have Jared Allen. It's at least piqued my interest to see how this looks for the rest of the year for Cleveland.
The last point I want to bring up with Caris is Caris is an over dribbler. He is an aggressive player. But the one thing that he does really, really well as a passer is hit the roll, man. And in Cleveland's case, they have Jared Allen, who's one of the best rim runners in the NBA.
Yeah.
And Lauri Markkanen, who's one of the best pick and pop players in the NBA. And Evan Mobley, who's an awesome short roll option. So a lot of diversity of roll options there for Karis. And he's really, really good at hitting that guy. He's in the top 30 point in the NBA this season in points derived from passing to the roll man in the NBA. So I don't know. I think it's not a not a bad option. And by the way, that number is from Synergy, who is just the best. By
the best. Shout out Karis and the Rollers. Shout out Synergy.
Shout out Matt Curley. Okay. Let's take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to get to the race for number one, which is our weekly segment that we tend to have fun with. Let's talk about a different kind of performance than what we're talking about with the NCAA tournament. They want to help your performance in the bedroom. Joy Mode, you know, just like on the basketball court, sometimes you might have an off night. Maybe you're playing okay and you want to take your game up a level even. That's where Joy Mode is going to come in. Don't grab some over-the-counter pills that you see at a gas station. They're going to often contain unregulated chemicals, suggest unsafe doses, carry the risk of several other health problems down the road. That's why we've partnered with Joy Mode. Whether you're looking to spice up your intimate moments or increase your confidence in the bedroom, Joy Mode makes all natural and science-backed supplements dedicated to helping men perform better across their core functions. Their trademark product, the Sexual Performance Booster, is every man's solution for increased performance. It's like a pre-workout, but for sex. And get this, all ingredients have been assessed in peer-reviewed journals and researched in humans. Imagine this, it comes in a palm-sized packet like your favorite electrolyte powder. Just simply mix it with 6 to 8 ounces of water 45 minutes before sexual activity begins, and you're going to watch the magic unfold. Redefine your intimacy and go to use joymode.com for 20% off with code GAMETHEORY. That's GAMETHEORY. That's 20% off and free shipping with code GAMETHEORY. Not only is this the only supplement you'll need in the bedroom, but it also supports blood vessel support, cardiovascular and heart health, athletic performance, blood pressure, and general erection function. So why settle for anything less? Whether you're happy or unhappy with your performance in the bedroom, why not perform even better with Joy Mode? Okay, we're back. This is going to be the Matt Penny show. I feel like I just talked for like 40 minutes out of 45 minutes.
I was in the batter's box just hoping you'd throw me a slider. I was prepared for fastball, the curve, the knuckleball. No slider, so it was good. there was no new deals that I didn't have at least a couple stats to pull up. But my comfort zone is still the draft. It's still the race for number one, the guys that I've watched every single week for the last God knows how long. So we're back to my comfort, my home food right here.
And we're particularly about to enter your home food here with Chet Holmgren just looks phenomenal. Holmgren has like
happening.
Genuinely taken the leap. Like it's not just, okay, like Chet Holmgren, he's a like contender for the number one overall pick, I guess. Like he's definitely in that top three mix. We're at the point with Chet where I think there is a very real case that he should be the number one overall pick over Jabari Smith. I don't know that I'm quite there yet, but it's essentially like 1A and 1B in my mind. You look at Chet's numbers last week, 23 points, 12 rebounds, 4 blocks against San Diego, made 3 threes in that game, shot 9-12 from the field. Against BYU, I mean, he was a fucking joke against BYU.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like 20 points, 17 rebounds, 6 assists, 5 blocks, 9 of 14 from the field. BYU is a top 30 team in the country. He obliterated them. It is one of probably, like we talked a lot about, like, hey, what's the best prospect game that we've seen this year earlier in the season? Like, I think we talked about that like right at the turn of the year or so.
Yep.
That is the best prospect game I've seen this year.
Top 4. It's in the mix.
Yeah. Like He annihilated BYU on both ends. He did every single thing that he will be asked to do in terms of translatability to the NBA in that game. Even over Johnny Davis against Purdue, even over Johnny Davis against Houston, I guess, over Ochai against Michigan State. That was the best prospect game I've seen from any player this year.
Jabari Smith
against BYU.
Jabari Smith against Alabama was ridiculous too. For Chet Holmgren, you know the saying that he does things on the court that you can't teach? Chet does things on the court that like you can't even fathom. And I've watched Chet for 5 years now, six years
now. It's like things you wouldn't even think to teach him.
Right. And even when you've seen him as much as I have, I'm still like surprised watching the game. And I was up Saturday night watching it at 11 o'clock or whatever it was. I'd love to, I couldn't look away. Like everything that was happening, like just didn't make sense. So the game before, we were going back and forth talking when he had 11 points in 90 seconds against San Diego. And he like blocks a shot, goes end to end, layup. Steal three. The announcers are laughing because that's the only like response that made sense. Like, what are we doing? They're rooting for him. Pitch it back. Hit him another one. Hits a three.
The one play was hysterical. It was like blocked shot, grab and go, like got his own rebound, like handed it off like right as he crossed half court, came back to Nembhard for a trailer three, and it's just like
It was 11 points in 90 seconds, like within the flow of what was going on, hey, I'm searching. I'm trying to get like one more, like I'm trying to get 30. It was within what they were doing. And then he does the, you know, seeing Wedding Crashers when they're playing football and there's an injury. They go, yeah, Dacherys. He did the run it back. They call timeout. He goes, yeah, Dacherys, run it back. Like, we'll do this again. We'll do another round. And then like he did, and Mark Few like had to talk to him. He said, hey man, we just celebrate with our teammates here because he did the two little thing early in the game too. He's like, don't do that. So I think now it's just like run it back to his teammates, like let's do it again.
By the way, like Mark, Drew Timmy has been telling guys that they're too small for like 2 years now.
With the mustache, like, but he's a grown man. But hey, whatever. Let Chet eat. He's a cheat code in the WCC. He is. I mean, a few of the plays, and I took notes from watching the BYU game because I'm going to forget this. I'm going to rewatch on Synergy. Here's just a few of them. He catches it in the post, and he finishes like over the top of his head. Like the rims here just finishes over the top of the head. I'm like, all right, that's strange. Out of pick and roll, they're in drop coverage, and the ball handler comes off. He's in drop coverage, and he still closes out and blocks the shot. I said, I don't know if I've seen that, like before, not a challenge. Like he reached out and blocked the shot. There was another play. He was called for a foul, but he blocked the shot. The ball went to a different guy. He recovered and blocked that guy's shot on his second jump. How do you do this on a basketball court? So this is where I'm at.
My brain doesn't compute him.
No, like, it doesn't. That's why it's so hard to put into words.
By the way, like the most impressive thing I saw him do this week was there was that play where he was like rim running and he fucking like OBJ style catches it one handed.
Nembhard. Yes. That was the one way above the rim down the far end of the court. Yeah.
Way above the rim. Yep. Somehow dunks it all in one fell swoop. And it's just like, this guy is fucking 7 foot tall. There is no way he should be able to do this. Like, there is no way that someone should be so coordinated that he should be able to go up, get that ball with one hand, his inside hand, by the way, which is an even harder catch than it is if he was going up with his left, catching it and dunking it all in one. I can't fathom someone who is like 6'9" making that catch, let alone like someone who's 7'1" and like gangly and still growing into his body.
Yeah.
Like, and his getting, coordination is insane.
And getting comfortable with the college game and actually getting his feet wet. And is his play just more about getting acclimated to college and everything clicking? Or some people point to, is it the competition level in the WCC where it's not their non-conference schedule, or was Duke, Texas, UCLA, Alabama, Texas Tech? I just think it's clicking. I know the post defenders and the guys closing out aren't the same caliber of talent or height or length or wingspan. The guys in WCC play shooting 69% of the field and 60% from three. I also start digging. I'm a big, like, let me see what opposing coaches are saying. Let me see what they say post game. And Mark Pope from BYU, the head coach, had a quote after the game, and it kind of made me twist my thinking a little bit. He said, he's a ball screen guy. You kind of have to pick your poison. You're either going to not switch him and give him up a 64% three-point shooter, or you're going to switch and you're going to have an undersized issue, which we had three times in the lane with him. So maybe I'm even looking at it, and I'm very high on Chet, but maybe I'm looking at it differently, where I thought he'd be a liability because he's so skinny, but maybe it's a strength because the defense doesn't even know like how to defend that. You're damned if you do, damned if you don't, when he catches the ball or doesn't catch it, because he scores so many different ways.
Yeah, and look, part of this is that BYU like starts two very undersized guards. Sure. So like if they're switching one of Tajon Lucas or Alex Barcelo onto Chet Holmgren, like they're fine, right? He has a foot on those guys.
Right.
Yeah. And like that's something that will happen occasionally in the NBA, but not as much, right? I just BYU is a top 40 team, top 30 team in the country.
They're good.
Right.
Yeah, they're good.
Like they're actually good. The teams near them in the KenPom rankings right now, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Florida, Michigan, Mississippi State, Providence. Providence is a top 10 team, you know, like Providence probably shouldn't be 42nd in KenPom, but I understand based off the math why they are. Chet Holmgren is so good right now. In terms of the way that he impacts both ends of the court, that to me is why that BYU game was the most impressive game I'd seen. Johnny Davis was great on offense against Purdue, and he was good on the ball defensively. He didn't completely obliterate everything Purdue wanted to do with the basket. Like he didn't completely, you know, make it so like it was impossible for Purdue to score. BYU in that game shot 33% from 2-point range.
Mm-hmm.
Like they couldn't go in there and score if they tried. They scored 57 points on 82 possessions. That was an 82 possession game. That was not like a 70 possession game where Gonzaga got hot. Like BYU, they did okay defensively. Like if we're being honest, like BYU was not, the defense was not the problem there. The problem was that they could not score effectively with Chet Holmgren in the game against Gonzaga. Like for him to go 20-17, he completely shut down the defensive side of the glass, obviously, like no second chance opportunities. That was an incredible basketball game. It was incredible.
It was when they were up by so many too. I honestly couldn't change the channel. I couldn't go to bed. I couldn't watch a different game because I was waiting for what Chet did next, because he was in such a groove on both sides of the floor. I didn't care. It was a 20-point game. Like I wanted to see the next play on defense. I want to see offensively, is he going to now shot fake and take it off the dribble and try to dunk on a guy? Is he going to hit another three? He's uncovering even more stuff that I didn't know he had in his offensive bag. I'm very curious to see kind of how this shifts, because we talked about doing a race for number one segment and said, yeah, maybe we'll do it for a week or two. It still feels like a race. Like I had Paolo number one. I had
Chet
number
one. I had Jabari number
one. It's all changing kind of by the week. And I don't want to be too like hot takey and say, hey, every week I have a new number one guy, but it's still a battle. Like I don't think anything is set in stone.
Well, I want to just like kind of let you tell me what you said on the phone yesterday. Like it's a literal roller coaster. Like I think that's like the best comparison at this point.
It is. And I think we're kind of like, you know, Jabari was like all the way up like a week ago. It's this guy's a runaway and he's doing everything right. Then he had a couple okay games. He only had 7 field goal attempts versus Georgia when KD Johnson and Wendell Green combined for 39. So he was just all right. Paolo, we've seen just kind of the lack of scoring at times and creation, which is kind of nuts because he was noted for that. I don't think did he take a shot? Did he score in the second half of the game yesterday against Virginia?
Took one shot, did not score against Virginia.
So like they're kind of going here and Chet's going up, but hey, it's a roller coaster. It's not Splash Mountain. It's not one drop. Like we're going to go back up. I don't know where it ends up during the year. And we kind of have to frame it too of who they're playing and who they're playing with and next to. But yeah, it's probably like a slight edge to Chet right now, despite last week me saying definitively it was Jabari Smith. Jabari Smith's a fantastic prospect, could still be number one. if we're just going based on a week or two and the development of what we've seen in front of us and our eyes, it's Chet Holmgren for the moment.
Are you at the point, and this is a good question that will involve this Virginia game against Duke, where Virginia beat Duke 69-68, I believe, was the final score. Duke was terrible defensively in that game. The last possession was like a pretty real breakdown from Mark Williams, where it looked like Mark thought they were supposed to be in zone, and they weren't, and he left the inbound man, and that was Reese Beekman, and Reese Beekman went out and knocked down a game-winning three. Banchero was also not awesome on defense in that game. Like, Tony Bennett did a really good job of kind of isolating him in space, I thought, and trying to take advantage of what he brought to the table. On top of that, like, he didn't score in the second half. Are you at the point where you're considering this potentially a two-person draft, given that I know you've been lower on Paulo throughout the year? You have seen him more in the Jaden Ivey, Johnny Davis range, where you have those guys ranked. Are you at the point where you see this as more of a Chet and Jabari draft as opposed to like Chet, Jabari, and Paulo, or are you, you know, still like in that five person range? Like, where are you at on this?
Chet and Jabari for me. And then the next kind of tier is, and I don't have orders, but the next tier is Paulo, Jaden Ivey, and Johnny Davis. And Jaden Ivey's been significantly better than Johnny Davis the last week or two. Johnny's hit some rough shooting performances. Penn State really shut him down. I think it's like 2 for 14. With Paulo, it's just he's stripped too often off the dribble. There's too much hesitation getting to his move, where it should be more of a catch and shoot. The efficiency has dropped. He was 5 for 15 against Louisville, 10 for 22 against Notre Dame, 5 for 14 against North Carolina. Not great last night. Just the holes are showing themselves more. And then on the Duke roller coaster, he's also next to AJ Griffin, who's now Superman, depending on the game, where he has 27 points against North Carolina, 3 for 6 from three, throwing a beach ball in the ocean. That's how big the hoop is. And then last night, he's sort of pedestrian. And I think AJ and Paulo will kind of go like this. The Paulo from the beginning of the year, I still, regardless of how well he was playing, it was, can he shoot from three? Is he able to defend in space? Is he able to guard up and down the lineup? Where the Jabari Smith and Chet Holmgren, I just simply think can do more. And I'm worried about Paulo's going to be able to score, but how's that fit going to be defensively? And if there's really no 3-point shot there, and he's really taking one shot in the second half against Virginia, those are the type of things that make me kind of put him down that second tier as opposed to the first one.
No, I think that's right. Okay. We're at an hour. We've done well. I feel like we've been responsible.
Good. Yeah, this is pretty good.
We don't have a mailbag segment. So let's talk about what we wanted to talk about in terms of a second draft topic today. And we're talking about it following a game where one of the guys I wanted to mention here, Mark Williams, I didn't think was very good last night against Virginia. I know he had 16 points.
He wasn't. We prepped this whole thing because he's playing so well. And that's like, oh, do we miss our already before we even done the segment?
But something that I've kind of had a conversation with a couple people on Twitter is this idea that, are the centers who project as potential starting centers in the NBA, Mark Williams, Christian Coloco, I think has a shot to be that, and Walker Kessler at Auburn, I think has a shot to be that.
Yep.
Are we underrating how good they've been so far this year? Those are three of the best defensive players in college basketball this year. Like, I would argue three of probably the five best, even though Mark did not play well on that end last night. Walker had a couple games early in the season where he wasn't great. I don't know that Coloco's had like a total fucking stinker on that end yet, to be honest. But no. Nonetheless, I guess my point is, like, you and I, particularly, like, we can acknowledge our flaws here, I think.
Oh, we always do.
Yeah. You and I tend to not disregard centers, but devalue the center position a little bit because there are so many of them in the marketplace in the NBA. I'll be honest, like having talked to teams around the NBA trade deadline this year, There's so many teams chasing centers right now.
it just changes by the year. It's like we devalue centers, then we prioritize centers. We want Bam Adebayo. We don't want Bam Adebayo. We want big facilitators. Oh, let's trade Tyrese Halliburton. It changes by the year and the season. Like, does anyone know what they're doing? And I'd add a couple more bigs to that group. I'd add EJ Liddell, who's playing really well, and he might be early second. That's fine. I also add Jalen Duren, who I don't think is necessarily the best evaluation prospect-wise type-ish place at Memphis. Walker Kessler, it seems at least the last, say, 2 to 3 weeks has kind of jumped those guys. And I have him in, like, the early 20s. I don't know if I would take a center.
Wait, I'm sorry. Do you think Walker Kessler has jumped Jalen Duren?
No, but the first guys you mentioned, Christian Coloco and Mark Williams, or that kind of grouping. Because you're still going to take Duren based off the high school stuff, the flashes. I still remember the Jalen Duren that was MVP of Pangos Camp and won Peach Jam like 6 months ago. So I actually watched some of his stuff last night too and said, it's still there. There's still flashes there in a game of Duren blocking shots and running the court and make some really nice passes. Yep. He's got to eliminate some of the crazy passes, and not everything has to be a no look and not everything has to be razzle dazzle. Like, you can just make a simple one once in a while. Yeah. But Kessler, anyway, I don't know if I would take him higher than 20. He's right up to where he should be. Mark Williams, I think I have around 25 or so. Christian Coloco, I love the defense. I am worried about the offense, and I don't want to say it's like a zero offensively, but there's a lot of post stuff that's pretty mechanical, and it's just like clean up, and he'll box out. I don't know.
He has more offensive possessions, Coloco, where it is like, this
right. So I don't
non-starter. Like, some of them are like really, really bad, where he's like bricking the ball off the glass on it, like a weird mechanical post move.
And he does the beginning stuff right. He makes a huge target. He gets low. He carves out a lot of space. I can't get there with the offense. I mean, the work and the development he put in during the offseason shows. He's doubled his points, his rebounds, his blocks. He's as good a defensive five in the country. I like how vocal he is on defense. He covers so much ground to get across the lane and help. I mean, there was a play against USC where he like walled up and then like still like blocked the shot. There's a game. Yeah. There's a play against UCLA where he got caught in a switch on the perimeter and he's on Tiger Campbell and the ball goes in the post. And he darts down and blocks that shot. There's value in that. But if the offense is not a zero, but not a huge game changer, that's a late first round guy that can come off the bench, but I don't know if necessarily an NBA starter off the jump.
Yeah. I've been wondering if he is kind of the closest thing we've seen to Clint Capella since Capella came in, and Capella went late first round as well.
Yeah.
Maybe should have gone earlier given the way his career has gone. But a guy that, you know, early in his career, Coloco's done his early career at Arizona. Capella just did it in the NBA, was very raw, like not an incredible amount of skill, really like had to learn the feel stuff, like really had to learn just like not being mechanical, like playing fluid basketball. And I think there are a lot of tools there with Coloco where I see some similarities. I did like Capella's frame a little bit better than Coloco's. Coloco just has a very skinny lower half that worries me a little bit, just in terms of getting pushed around a bit more than what you would like to see. But he does high point the ball really, really well because of that length, because of that anticipation on the glass. Like, I think he does a pretty okay job there. The defensive, like, rim protection, the way they utilize him, I think is outstanding. They do such a great job. And look, Tommy Lloyd is coming from that Gonzaga staff where that staff for a decade now has been the best staff in college basketball at teaching the principle of verticality, teaching how to stay upright around the basket, teaching not fouling around the basket. This has been just the best. You go back through the history of Gonzaga, even guys like Shemek Karnowski were utterly outstanding at it. Zach Collins had a really good backing in it. You know, the list goes on and on, right? Like, we can go to like Jonathan Williams, the Missouri kid who transferred there, got really, really good at it. So it's not a surprise that as Tommy Lloyd got to Arizona, Koloko took a leap in terms of his positioning and in terms of his ability to stay big. And then they also use him in a deep drop, not even just like a flatter drop. They use him like they'll set like a high ball screen, the opposing team, and Koloko will stand at the like foul line or even like inside the foul line without concern. They force the guards to fight over the top. Sometimes the guards fight over the top. Sometimes, you know, you give up a pull-up jumper, and I think for the college level, that's fine, right? At the end of the day, Koloko might be the best defensive player in college basketball. Like,
yeah, he's close. I mean, we talked about Chet Holmgren earlier. Walker Kessler certainly has a case. I mean, Bruce Pearl was talking about him last night during a halftime interview and said, you know, he adjusts as well in the air and recovers better than anybody in the country. Yeah. It's hard to argue. And they're able to play their pace and their style because of how he's like the protector in the back. He's the guy that, that he's the calm within the storm. He's the steady hand that they have in the anchor of their defense.
And Koloko is like very long. And like in terms of the way that like his arms extend high, like I would venture that his standing reach in like max vertical standing reach whenever he's protecting the rim is probably a little bit higher than Walker Kessler. But Kessler is just, he feels bigger in the way that he takes up space in the paint. Like he just feels like he is a presence there constantly. Like Koloko, it feels like you can kind of turn the corner on him because he's so skinny. And then he'll just recover and block your shot, right? Because that's like what he's capable of with his length and with his quickness. It feels hard to even just get by Kessler.
He always recovers. He's still there. It's like, don't shoot it. He's going to block it. And he always does.
Yeah, it's really hard.
And I just think that like the Kessler offense is just so much further along than all these guys. Like, I don't think. Like that play he had last week where it was either a short roll or he popped. He took one dribble from free throw line and dunked. I don't know if any of these guys are really doing that right now. I know his three-point percentage is still like 20%. I don't know if those guys are, with the exception of E.J. Liddell, who does more of the offensive fluidity type stuff. But in terms of like trailing and getting the three off, I don't think you're really going to see that necessarily right now from Christian Koloko or Mark Williams.
Well, and we should talk about Mark Williams. He feels like the middle ground to me between the two. To be honest, better hands than Koloko, same like measurements, I think, with like similar level athleticism, probably a little bit farther along in terms of his offensive dexterity, better touch around the basket, I think. I don't feel like the ball is immediately going to be turned over whenever he puts the ball on the ground, like for one dribble, like off of a short roll. Not quite as big as Kessler, not quite as skilled as Kessler, but much more athletic than Kessler, I think. Like, seems to move a little bit better. That's why I've had Mark Williams a little bit higher. Like, I have Mark as a top 20 guy right now because I think he's kind of the middle ground between those two in, like, a pretty real way. Like, he should be able to be, like, a great drop coverage big defender while also being a great rim runner who can attack and finish above the basket and be an incredible lob threat. So I don't know.
He owns the role of it too, right? He's in the 99th percentile in points per possession. He shoots 70% from the field after shooting 60% from the field last year. He's only taken double digit shots three times this season. He's playing on such a loaded Duke team with studs and draft guys that he's found a way to distinguish himself or separate himself. When he's out there, one game he's just catching lobs. The next, he's finding cutters out of the post. He had a mid-range jumper the other night. Duke becomes so much more dangerous when he has like that offensive type threat to his game, but he doesn't also like seek out the stuff. He's not stomping his feet when he doesn't get a touch, and that's what I like it within the NBA system down the line is you're not going to be a rookie as a five man getting a short roll touch. Like, get some rebounds, rim run, keep the pressure on. Yep. The opposing defense and just make your points and get your baskets and protect the rim when you can.
Yeah, no, I think that's all right. The point of this exercise, and I don't know that I want to talk about EJ Liddell because EJ is like more of like a 6'7" 4 man who might play some small ball five. Like, he's a little bit different. And Jalen Duren, like, he's not an inefficiency. in terms of where he's priced, right? Like, you're going to have to take Jalen Duren at the very least, like it feels like in the back half of the lottery.
Yeah, it'll probably be tough for him to top 15 play the lottery. Top 15. Yeah. Fine.
So I wonder, to close the loop on this, do we think that Christian Coloco, Walker Kessler, and Mark Williams, given that we're hunting, like, let's be real about it too. Like, we're hunting for players. We're trying to find guys that are guaranteed first round picks right now. I wonder if those three are, like, have emerged into clear first round picks. Assuming that half the guys that, you know, we think are on the fence, your Max Christie's, your Peyton Watsons, your Josh Minot's,
the fence sitter group. That's why it's so hard, right? It's Bryce McGowan's,
Kennedy Chandler, you know, X, Y, and Z. Let's say like half those guys go back to school, half those guys stay in the draft. Like, it's going to open up a lot of first round pick opportunities potentially for guys that were productive upperclassmen. The only problem is there haven't been a ton of productive upperclassmen that have really stepped up there and emerged into that first round level prospect. So I wonder if that's the group, if that's the group we're looking at that ends up like kind of emerging into that range.
It could be. And when I do my big board, I color code it based off guys I think that may test and go back, just so I have that like thought process in my head. Like if Watson, Wesley, Christie, Minot, Harrison Ingram, Trevor Keels, JD Davidson, I mean, that's seven guys right there who's probably at least the top 35 or so. Caleb Houston, haven't mentioned him yet. Amina Muhammad's a little bit lower. There's a lot of like testy guys that they might go to workouts, might go to the combine, take a look and come back. And those bigs, I think Kessler's fine. I think Mark Williams will probably be fine, but Coloco can solidify his standing if and when those guys say, hey, we're going to go back or whatever it may be. But there's going to be openings because we are still searching. Like, I watched Kansas last night it was Kansas. I'm like, is Christian Brown a first-round guy? Maybe. Bryce McGowan's is another name. Like, is he tested? Does somebody say, does Indiana get crazy at 22 and say, hey, we're going to promise Harrison Ingram, he just like fits what we want to do offensively, and that spot's gone. So they'll be in the mix. I'm just hesitant to say they're definitively there right now until we get more information on that freshman crop of pre-draft guys that we're just going to keep talking about here until draft night, it seems like.
Yeah, no, I agree. Okay, prospect of the week, the game theory NBA draft prospect of the week, Matt Penny, you're up first.
I'm up first. Wow, that's great. So I'm opening my notes. I'm going here. Game theory prospect of the week. I text this one to you, and then he promptly had 25 points. Stole my thunder a little bit, but I'm going to Quavion Smith from NC State. So he's averaging around 16 points, 4 rebounds a game as a freshman. He had 34 points on the road against North Carolina. He had 25-6 against Syracuse, shooting 41% from the field. A little bit of a backstory. So he was a top 100 kid coming out of high school, had a strong finish to his high school career. But like many, he was having his true breakout during the COVID summer that not a lot of people saw him and none of as many grassroots eyes were fixated around him. So he kind of like slipped through the cracks a little bit. That being said, I didn't anticipate him coming out with the numbers that he has out the gates. I've watched North Carolina State closely a number of times. It was admittedly because of Darion Sebron, and I'm like, okay, how does he fit? Is he a real NBA guy? And I kept getting pulled back to Quavion Smith. It's the scoring package with Pops. The announcers in that North Carolina game said that Kevin Keith calls for Quavion the most unique player he's ever coached because of his confidence. And when you watch them, you can see the confidence. He doesn't need screens to free himself. despite the little bit of low release, he's chucking, he's getting off, he gets off cleanly, quickly. As an isolation scorer, he knows to extend and pushes the ball ahead of himself, gets up and down transition, has a floater in his bag, has a 15-footer, can shoot off ball reversals, just an unwavering belief in his own game and ability. There's still some crazy attempts in there. There are. And as somehow his confidence has blossomed even more this season, he's close up to like 18 shots per game. So like he knows the light is green and he's shooting. I think he's a classic year away prospect. Let's look at him and see what it is long term when he tightens up some of those other aspects of his game, while still being confident and showing that scoring prowess all over the floor. It can't always be the one-on-one score stuff outside of the flow of the offense. Can't always be pull out and let me get to it. I think some more size will help him convert more in the lane too. As a freshman, I had little to no expectations for him, and he certainly made enough of a case for himself to put himself on a tracking radar for future draft cycles.
So I love Tre'Quavion Smith. I tweeted about him probably a month ago and said, like, oh yeah, like I feel like if he goes back to NC State next year, he'll average like 17 points a game.
Yeah. He's doing it now.
Probably average 17 yeah, points a game in the ACC this year. I'm a really big fan. Like, and you kind of, the way that you outlined it, I thought was perfect because all of the skills that you outlined are things that translate directly to the NBA as a scoring guard, right? Like that ability to play off the 2 feet, play in the lane, play on balance, get to that floater shot, pull up 3-point ability. He's really sudden, I think, in the way
that's a good word for it. He is sudden.
Yeah, like he's very sudden in the way that he gets to his moves, gets to his pull-up game. Attacks, like he's very aggressive, obviously looking for a shot, but the way that he separates is like violent almost. Like he has this ability to just push guys way back and then stop on a dime and just get that bit of separation to where it almost doesn't matter that the release point is as low as it is,
right?
Because he's creating so much backward separation. I've been kind of wondering if he's a 2022.
Oh boy, like, don't do that to me. No, why?
I know, but and like I don't think he should.
Don't I have enough freshmen that I can't figure out like if they're good or not or first round picks? Why are we doing this?
I mean, he should 100% test this year. Oof. Like, no question, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're averaging this many points in the ACC. We're trying to. He's been a better offensive
player than Bryce McGowan's, and we're talking about Bryce McGowan's testing and potentially being in this draft. Like,
right. Possible.
He should test. Like Tre'Quavion Smith should test for this draft. I think he should go back. Like physically, he is not ready to play in the NBA.
Right.
But I wonder if we look at him and he is like the Johnny Davis, like emerging Ooh. Prospect next year.
Well, I think
he's not good. He's not as good defensively as Johnny
no,
is.
No, he's not.
And he's not Johnny's as physically
have, yeah, like, stout Johnny's always and had strong. Like that stronger, wider frame yeah. base. The defense isn't there, but the scoring package is more diverse. The way he scores, absolutely.
I mean, he might average like a very translatable 20 points a game as a
yeah.
sophomore.
Yeah,
if he goes back and like those guys going sophomores that average 20 points in the ACC in like ways that are directly translatable to the NBA, like those guys go in the lottery if they right. do that. So, could use some efficiency. Needs the strength. Needs a lot still. Like. I don't think he would be successful going to the NBA next year. I think he'd probably really struggle, to be honest. And he needs to round out his game, really needs to round out the way that he sees the court as a passer. But I like him a lot. I think
there's
he's like
there.
A legit.
There's something there.
Like, I think he is an NBA player. Like, when I watch him, I'm like, I'm watching an NBA player play basketball.
Yeah.
I feel
like I totally agree with him and with you. And that's why I thought. Needed at least an extended mention here as opposed to a couple tweets because he's scoring, he's doing it. You don't have that. I mean, you kind of didn't catch me off guard, but at the same time, I didn't prepare for you to say like, well, what about this draft? And maybe that's something that needs to be discussed a little bit more, or maybe he's trying to keep on toes.
Like in a perfect world, he should absolutely be a 2023 guy. It's just yeah. like, we're hunting this year. Like I keep saying, like we're hunting for players this year to find that are first round picks.
We need to Photoshop both of us like wearing orange hunting suits with guns and just like Photoshopped onto a draft hunting late first
like
hunting.
I think we're,
it's gonna happen. I think we're kind of like semi, we have an idea of the lottery, change a few names yeah. here and there. 16 on. It's like, whatever, man, Jeremy Sohan, Tre'Quavion Smith. Sure.
Let's
great.
Do it.
Maybe
I'm in. Okay, the guy that I'm recognizing is the antithesis of Tre'Quavion Smith, like in every single imaginable way, and yet is one of the most productive players in college basketball. It is David Roddy at Colorado State. Oh, he yeah. is probably my favorite player to watch in college basketball this year. It is such a unique skill set. While I pull up what David Roddy is listed at,
I know what he's listed at. I looked to okay. see what he was listed at for this exercise. What do you think he is versus what he's listed at is the question.
Yeah, David Roddy is listed at 6'6", 255. I don't think he's 6'6".
Yeah, I don't think he's 255. Yeah,
I don't know if he's 255. I don't think he's either. He might be a little bit heftier than that. But God damn it, is he good at basketball?
Yeah.
He is so skilled. Like, when I watch him shoot the basketball, like, there are times where I'm like, okay, he's taking jumpers off the catch. He's taking them confidently. Like, he's just getting right into it fluidly. He doesn't take a ton of jumpers, but when he takes them, I'm like, this guy is like one of the best shooters in the draft, just in terms of the way it comes out of his hand, the way that it mechanically, like he shoots 48% from three. I don't know why this guy's only taking 3 3-point attempts per game. Like, he should be taking 5 or 6. He can really fucking shoot the basketball. Mm-hmm. Very skilled off the bounce. Very powerful driver is the way to put it. Has incredible feet. Like, really high level footwork. Looks like a bowling ball out there. Like, legit looks like a powerful downhill bowling ball. Whenever he like pump fakes, attacks closeout, tries to get to the basket. Good offensive rebounder, like good defensive rebounder, blocks shots, always in the right position defensively. Always in the right position, just like in general. Like the ball just finds him. He moves really well without the ball. He seems to have like this innate skill level. Everyone has played basketball with someone in their life who like is this hefty basketball player who just understands how to carve out space, understands how to use his body, and also just has like unbelievable touch, right? Like has this incredible ability to just put the ball in the basket. David Roddy's that guy. He's just, it's just like most of the time, those guys that you play against, they fall off like around eighth grade or so. Like it's
the early bloomer. Even, he's been the same size as fourth grade, just falls off by the time.
Right. You're high school. It's hard for them to like really, you know, continue on with basketball in terms of the conditioning, in terms of everything like that. As you move up the levels.
Yeah.
David Roddy is doing it as a junior in college. He's 20 years old. He's actually really young for the junior class. I'm blown away when I watch David Roddy. I have no idea if it'll work in the NBA. I frankly think that like he's probably going to be a great EuroLeague player. But
awesome too, awesome EuroLeague.
Yeah,
with 18 points, 8 rebounds, and like a handful of like highlight assists or at least passes per game too.
Like I didn't even mention the passing. Like he's a real pass. Like everything about his feel for the game, everything about his brain in terms of the way it works on a basketball court is elite. And on top of that, he's a terrific shooter that I think is really going to translate to the next levels as a shooter. Do I think he can defend in space? No, like I don't. Like I think that he's probably going to get obliterated in space in the NBA because he's not quick enough. But I absolutely love him. I would want to bring him in for a workout if I was an NBA team. I would consider two-waying him if I was an NBA team. Oh. Just because, like, it is hard to find guys that are 6'6" that I think have potential to shoot like this. Like, he shoots directly off the hop. It's right in the shooter's pocket. Like, it looks perfect coming out of his hand. Like, he has great feel for the game. He's so productive. I want David Roddy to be, I'm, like, wishing into existence that David Roddy is an NBA player.
No, I thought you were going to say summer league. He's the ultimate break my brain when you watch him because I didn't expect what I saw. You saw the measurements, like, okay, this is going to be a back to the basket, kind of like old school 5e, 4. Mm-hmm. No, this man shoots. Like, he goes. Doesn't pass the eye
test. He's a perimeter big.
Yeah. And he's like the Mack truck with a sports car engine. Like, it doesn't work. It shouldn't. And somehow he does. Colorado State's really good. And it's largely because of him and what he's able to do on the floor. I'd like for him to be on a summer league roster, see what it looks like with different levels of athleticism. And you're not having most of the plays drawn up for you to come off screens and to create and to short roll and to do some stuff. But yeah, at the very least, he's a very fun watch in college basketball, and I'm going to keep watching. I was slow to get on the train. I had a few people reach out and say to watch him. It was one of those like 5 or 6 names. So I'm glad that he was your late addition and a great one as the Game Theory Prospect of the Week.
Yeah, I just love him. Like, I love watching him play basketball, and I don't know if it's going to work in the NBA, but I wanted to give him some love. I wanted to talk about him a little bit.
That's why we're here.
Okay. The most important thing we're going to talk about today. Oscar nominations came out today, Matt Penny.
This is a big day for you.
This is a big day for me.
Yep.
What were your initial impressions of the Oscar nominations?
None. And the reason I say that is I don't think I've necessarily like watched enough of the movies that were nominated since Parasite won, which was what, 3 years ago?
Yeah.
So I've kind of just fallen off. I've just watched more basketball. Ago, I think, but yeah. 2 years ago? Okay. More basketball, more TV shows, more based on everything else. I'll give the floor to you. I assume Licorice Pizza was going to be nominated for 700 things and Dune was going to be nominated for 700 things. And we knew that In the Heights was going to get slighted. So I guess I'll just ping pong it back to you of what were your initial impressions on the Oscar nominations?
I mean, so like when you watched Dune,
mm-hmm.
Did you think
I did not see Dune. So
you haven't seen Dune yet? No, Dune is worth watching. Dune's okay. Like super cool. And it's like a like entertaining movie. Like it's not just a like Oscar bait movie. You know what I mean?
Right.
Dune is interesting for a number of reasons. It's incredible in terms of like set design, production design, costume, like cinematography. Like that movie, I think that like what my review was on Letterboxd was like, I think that this looked like the most expensive movie I've ever seen made. Like it just
more so when you watched it was more expensive. Like when I watched Avatar, I'm like, oh, this is $1 trillion to make. I don't know how they afford this budget. You thought it was more so than that.
Similar thing. Similar thing with Dune, where it's just like this had to have cost $1 billion to make this thing. Right. Like in terms of scale, like it just is so massive and looks unbelievable in terms of like the way it's shot. For Denis Villeneuve to not get nominated for Best Director for that, but for the movie to get 10 nominations,
rare,
almost like breaks my brain, kind of.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to recognize the movie, it's hard for me. Like I would have understood it more logically if the movie got like 2 nominations than it getting 10 nominations and not getting director, because like, it's just one of those movies where that makes sense. Kristen Stewart Hive still exists. We're back. We're up and running. The Spencer Hive is real. Spencer is one of the 5 best movies I saw last year. I love it unconditionally. I think it's great. Have you seen Coda?
Yeah. No, I'm looking at the list now. I think the only movie I've watched here was The Lost Daughter, which I told you was just, I get it. Like the acting was very strong, just a little too artsy for me. But you're the movie connoisseur. You watch 100 times more movies than me. Is this a down year for movies? Do you think it was kind of consistent what it has been the last few? Like I'm looking here and just based on names alone, like King Richard, fine, but did it not have as much kind of pop at the top that it normally does, where everyone's seen like 2 or 3 Best Picture nominations? We look at now, it's like maybe the casual movie fan has seen 1.
Yeah, maybe, like I would imagine like the casual movie fan has seen Dune and like maybe 1 other, and that's it. Like this has potential to be like a really bad Oscars telecast.
It has to be. As I'm looking, and it's not even like the traditional kind of like, you'll get mad at me because it'll be like Javier Bardem, Benedict Cumberbatch. There are big names, but not necessarily like the knock you over the head type guys. I mean, Best Actor is kind of loaded with Will Smith and Denzel Washington.
Yeah,
but just the movies without having like that blockbuster to sneak in, it might be a little bit of a rough ratings run for them.
Yeah, and on top of that, a lot of the movies in that group, like, they aren't movies that I think people love.
Yeah.
Like, I think that a lot of them are like, oh, yeah, that was a nice movie. Like, Belfast, that was a nice movie. Like, it's cool that, you know, Kenneth Branagh made a movie about growing up in Belfast. Like, cool. We got to see Jamie Dornan sing. That's nice.
Yeah.
King Richard, like, you know, Will Smith. That's great.
Yeah, that's good.
We'd love to get Will Smith like an Oscar. That's great. He's fine in the movie. Like the movie's fine. It's nice. Like Nightmare Alley's 2.5 hours. It's like, again, like another movie where like the scale, it's just like, I don't know how this didn't cost $150 million looking at it. But like, it's 2.5 hours, and I don't know how Guillermo del Toro, like, I don't know how he convinced any studio. I guess, like, coming off an Oscar with Shape of Water, like, he got what he wanted, but that movie should not be 2.5 hours. Like, it right. just shouldn't be. I still haven't seen Licorice Pizza yet. That's not, like, it just hasn't come out here yet for whatever reason.
Oh, interesting. It's strange.
Yeah.
It's
all over the like place I could
here.
Probably.
It's playing down the street at the local art house movie cinema here.
Yeah, like maybe I'll find like someone I know in like one of the guilds and stream it or something like that, like using a VPN. But I haven't been able to see it yet. Yeah, no, it's weird. Like, it's just weird. This is not a, to me, this was a movie year of like solid, okay movies, not like a, you know, oh my God, like this, there are four.
What's
going to
win?
That, like,
what are you going to do? Like, who's going to pick? Somebody's going to get snubbed. Doesn't feel like that appetite's there.
Yeah, no, like it doesn't feel like this is a year where it's like, oh, like there's no way that The Power of the Dog shouldn't win.
Like, is there a movie like, that you're rooting for that like you want to win all this stuff? And that's when I really get drawn in. And I grew up watching the Oscars all the time. I think part of it too is with COVID and the stuff shutting down, I haven't prioritized like going back out to the actual movie theaters. Yeah. And then if you're home, it's like, let me watch something dumb on TV. I don't want like 2 hours of just like locked into a crazy serious movie. So until I think I kind of shift back into that world, it's hard for me to watch, because you do watch when you're rooting for something that you've seen. You maybe identify with the characters, you identify with the story, the director, and you want them to kind of be up on their stage and giving a speech where they say like, hey, I didn't write anything, but here's 5 minutes of notes and people I have to thank.
Yeah, like just kind of looking through Best Picture here, like Nightmare Alley, it's just going to be inaccessible for people because it's 2.5 hours. Don't Look Up, I didn't like Don't Look Up. Like I
thought it was fine, but I didn't think it was, exactly what you're saying. I didn't leave saying Best Picture. Like, no way.
Yeah. Dune, like I think Dune is an incredible achievement. Like I wouldn't mind Dune winning. Drive My Car, I haven't seen that yet. That's a Japanese film that apparently is very good that I just haven't seen yet. Belfast is fine. Licorice Pizza is one I haven't seen. Power of the Dog is really good. I don't know if it's like Best Picture good. But like in terms of like winning, but it's like a good nominee in a good year. West Side Story's good. Like King Richard's good. Coda. I mean, Coda is like a really nice movie that is about like child of deaf adults. And I really enjoyed my time with it when I watched it this week. It's nothing we haven't seen before in terms of like a romantic comedy and like coming of age story. So I don't know. Like, and then you look at the Best Actor nominees. It's like, okay, this is, all these performances are okay. Like, I don't think there's anything that's like blown me away there. I was excited that like Being the Ricardos like didn't get nominated for Best Picture. Although
you're on that train.
I legitimately forgot J.K. Simmons was in Being the Ricardos and he got nominated for Supporting Actor. Like, nobody saw that happening
until it rolled out.
Yeah. Like nobody saw that as like a thing that was going to happen. And I had completely forgotten that he was in that movie. And I was
the Academy did not forget Sam. And that's the most important
clearly.
Thing. Clearly.
Unbelievable. But yes, the thing I'm most excited about is Kristen Stewart getting nominated for Best Actress. Kristen Stewart, Hive is Strong. That is the only important thing that really matters, in my opinion. Spencer, so Hive is Strong. We love the movie Spencer. We love Kristen Stewart. That's all I've got on the Game Theory Podcast for today. I have to go write because I have to write like a billion things. Right. I have rookie rankings coming out. I'm going to have something on the Halliburton Sabonis thing coming tonight, probably. Penny, tell the people where they can find you.
Find me on Twitter, Matt_Penny. And I'm on the road. We got eyeballs on prospects this weekend. We're starting up at UMass, the alma mater, the place St. Joe's, get some Jordan Hall evaluations in person. I'm taking a short drive down to Boston College where Duke comes to town. So I'll get eyeballs on Paul Bancaro, on AJ Griffin, Wendell Moore, Keels, Mark Williams, who just talked about. So I'm looking forward to all that.
Are you going with our nameless mutual friend?
Leg one, yes.
Leg one?
Yeah, I'm at UMass to start, and then I'm driving 2 hours back home to Boston.
Oh, you're going
to BC and going too? Yeah.
Yeah, I was excited to know if he was going to Duke because I can just imagine you guys like sitting there just like shitting on Duke. Like, while we're watching this Boston College game. No,
I can't do that.
Oh my God.
Love okay. That's after. That's group text stuff. That's not in person.
Yeah. We'll talk. Not that Penny like shits on Duke, like in our group text, even really, ever. But we have had conversations about Paolo Banchero and, Matt's feelings have been known on this podcast
No secrets.
What he thinks about Banchero. I have a bunch of writing coming this week. I've already written on the Caris LeVert deal. You can go find that at The Athletic. I'll have something on Halliburton tonight. I will have something on rookie rankings for tomorrow. I will be active writing about trades as they occur at the deadline. I just want to thank everyone for listening. Sharing some of the metrics with Matt earlier this week, just because, you know, preparing for some things and trying to figure some things out. And just really appreciate it. Like, it's fantastic. The podcast has grown so substantially over the course of the last, I don't know, like year and a half. A lot of it coincides with Matt being on, who's just the best.
I think those are bad metrics, but it does grow. It has grown, and it's nice. We're doing this here and being recorded, and we have the actual people that listen and poke holes at that. So it's crazy, man. It's good stuff.
Yeah. Like, the sheer number of people like that listen to this is staggering to me. It blows my mind. And listen to us just like ramble and talk shit for hours on end.
Hour and 40 minutes.
Genuinely, thank you. If you want to watch us, you can watch us on the YouTube channel, Game Theory Podcast with Sam Vecini. I think that's what it's called. Go find that. Go to The Athletic. Go to theathletic.com/gametheory. Subscribe there. It lets The Athletic know that we are a viable like product that is worth continuing to allow like to do nonsense. So go there. But until next time, we will talk soon. Bye.